On this week's edition of New York Now, Governor Andrew Cuomo will lay out his plan for the state's $6 billion budget deficit next week. We'll have a preview. Plus, a look at the women's rights agenda in New York. And the debate over the state's new bail reform laws continues. We'll hear from a Democrat on possible changes. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.
Today, the Senate majority will pass
a law. We will pass a law prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Get another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. We're just days away from Governor Andrew Cuomo's 10th address on the state budget. We'll finally find out how Cuomo plans to fill a $6 billion budget deficit and what that'll mean for the state's economy. We'll have more on that later in the Reporters Roundtable. But first, after a series of earthquakes rocked the island of Puerto Rico, Cuomo took a trip to the island this week to offer aid from New York State. Cuomo said during a press conference in Puerto Rico that New York will be sending engineers and utility experts to address power outages, as well as other resources.
Until the tremors stop, it is an ongoing situation that has to be managed. And nobody can tell you today when the tremors will actually stop. So it's unique in that regard.
Back in New York, Democrats passed a series of measures intended to place stronger restrictions on limousines. The new laws come after 20 people were killed in a deadly crash last year in Schoharie County. The new requirements will allow the state to seize limos deemed unsafe and mandate new seatbelt requirements, among other measures. And a ban on the sale of flavored e-cigarettes in New York has been deemed unconstitutional by a state judge in Albany. The ban was first proposed by Cuomo last year after a series of vaping-related deaths around the country. Democrats in the legislature are now trying to enshrine the ban into state law, which could provide stronger protections against a legal challenge. The bill is still in committee for the time being. The state of Virginia, meanwhile, ratified the Equal Rights Amendment in a historic move this week. As the nation debates the fate of the measure in the Constitution, lawmakers in New York are considering other legislation on issues affecting women. Reporter Jessica Marshall and producer Nicole Van Slyke took a look at what's been accomplished for the women's agenda in New York and what's ahead.
1920 was a big year for women in New York and across the nation. It was the year the United States ratified the 19th Amendment, guaranteeing women the right to vote.
We get to celebrate the fact that we have hit that 100-year milestone for the nation. Now, 3 years ago, in 2017, I chaired a commission to celebrate the centennial in New York State. And that gave us an opportunity not just to do a look back and talk about how brave and audacious these women were, even back to 1848 when they had that first women's rights convention. The whole nation was looking at what was going on in Little Seneca Falls. New York is really the epicenter of women's rights. So using that narrative, it propelled us to take that message to our legislators around the state, say, okay, torch has been passed to us, what do we do with it? And if not us, then who?
So 100 years is a good time to reflect. We've made some enormous gains, but much of this has just happened in a blink of an eye. We haven't had many of these rights for very long.
In 1963, the Federal Equal Pay Act prohibited wage discrimination on the basis of gender. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act in 1974 made it easier for women to get credit cards. In 1978, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act outlawed firing women for being pregnant.
This is recent history, but sometimes we forget how many gains have been made, and we don't realize how fragile those gains are.
In his State of the State address in Albany this month, Governor Andrew Cuomo pushed for several items on his women's agenda, among them elimination of the pink tax, which charges women as much as 13% more than men for personal care products. Also on the list, eliminating the rape intoxication loophole, and he wants to add sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity to the list of the state's protected classes, to create what he calls a first-in-the-nation inclusive equal rights amendment.
Because New York believes justice delayed for women is justice denied for women.
New York enacted a law last year that expanded the provisions of the state's current equal pay laws. The new act mandates equal pay for substantially similar work. That means men and women in different roles that are substantially similar must receive equal wage rates. State Senator Alessandra Biaggi, a Democrat representing Westchester and the Bronx, wrote the bill.
Equal Pay Act is an example of women and men identifying an issue and trying to solve it through policy, which is, of course, always one of the ways to change culture. I think that we can pass as many laws as we want until we turn blue in the face, but until a majority of people, New Yorkers and Americans and the world really, understand and appreciate that women and the work that they do is just as important as the work that our male counterparts do, the law is not necessarily going to fulfill what we're trying to do, which is change the culture and actually have equality.
I think it's a good question to ask, why don't women make the same as men? When women across the board make less than men, there's a problem. When you look at apples to apples, oranges to oranges, education level, job industry, fields, we see that women make less than men, even in female-dominated jobs like nursing.
I was victim to this when I was a young attorney in Washington, landed at a big law firm, but when I wanted to go to my dream job on Capitol Hill, I was offered a 50% pay cut, which I took because I really wanted to get into public service, but I didn't realize that the men next to me in my new congressional office were making quite a bit more, and they weren't even lawyers. They didn't have the same degree or experience. So we said that you can no longer ask about prior history with respect to salaries, and we think that that's going to be an important barrier that's overcome, that you'll be paid what you're worth for the job, not just a little bit more than your last job.
That's the salary history bill. It passed alongside the Equal Pay Act as a package that Cuomo called a victory for women. But he acknowledged in his 2020 State of the State address that there still is a long way to go for women's rights.
And let's be honest, women are still victims of cultural and institutional discrimination. And New York must lead in ending this continuing shameful and repugnant injustice.
I think it's one of those issues that you take on because you know it's bigger than you and you know that it's not going to be solved in your lifetime, and that's okay. But you're putting your voice to it is the justice that it deserves. So let's just keep doing it.
100 years after women were guaranteed the right to vote, New York has several women in prominent government roles. Kathy Hochul is the first female lieutenant governor. Andrea Stewart-Cousins is the first female leader of the Senate. Letitia James is the first female to be elected state attorney general. Senator Biaggi says that while women still have a fight ahead of them, New York is the place to be.
Women are a majority of the population in the state of New York, and New Yorkers and New York women are just sensational. And we should give them everything that they need to do everything that they can to succeed. Because if you are born here, or you live here, or you come here, I mean, you're limitless. And so that is what inspires me to be excited for and to fight for the women's agenda.
The debate over the new bail reform laws in New York continued this week in Albany. Democrats in the state legislature said again this week that they don't plan to change the law anytime soon, while Republicans said the measure is endangering public safety. Some Democrats appear to be open to changes, but they seem to have a long way to go to convince their colleagues at the Capitol. Meanwhile, members of law enforcement were in Albany this week to call for changes to the law. One of them was Mary Pat Donnelly, the district attorney for Rensselaer County. She's with me now in studio. Mary Pat, thank you very much for joining me.
Glad to be here, Dan.
So, DA Donnelly, I think there's been a lot of misinformation about this law. There's certainly been a lot of claims about it. Can you kind of explain what the changes were to bail reform? From what I understand, it was basically taking cash bail out of nonviolent and low-level charges. But if you have some more scope to that.
Sure. And that was how it was couched, and that was what we understood the intention to be, with the hope being that no one would be sent to jail simply because they couldn't afford bail. What ended up happening was bail no longer became about assessing the individual in front of the court, but instead became tied to the offense. So now there are a list of qualifying offenses for which a judge can set bail, and then there's no discretion thereafter. So previously a judge would look at an offender's criminal history, their ties to the community, their history of not appearing in court. That is no longer something that can be considered. It's all tied to the offense. And what's concerning from the DA's perspective is that there are a lot of offenses that we feel a person should be subject to potential pretrial incarceration.
So tell me a little bit more about that. If you had to tweak the law, if you wanted to see some changes, what are some of those changes that you want to see? Would you add more offenses to be eligible for bail, or maybe automatic remand, which is when a judge puts somebody in incarceration before trial?
Sure. There are a lot of offenses that I would add to the qualifying offense list. One of the ones that we've talked so much about is burglary in the second degree. These are home burglaries where you're going to see an individual accused of breaking into a residence, and then they're going to be out on the street.
Right.
Potentially seeing the person whose home they broke into at the local grocery store or at the gas station. So that's going to invoke a definite amount of fear. Locally, we've had a burglar in one of our larger towns who has offended 5 times in the recent months, and he was just released last week, fully aware of the fact that he had no potential to be pretrial incarceration. So the offenders are learning the system already, and that is what is concerning. I mean, that is the main concern, that somebody is going to be released on their own recognizance and commit another crime.
So I don't want to be all negative about it, but I know that, so you're a Democrat. I forgot to mention that at the top of the interview, but you're a Democrat, and I have to assume there are some changes to the law that you supported. Tell me about the good parts of this law that may be having some beneficial changes to the community.
Sure. I think the fact that we can ensure that someone is not being held based upon their inability to pay is a good thing. I just don't know that this law, while it accomplishes that, it has taken away the opportunity to evaluate the person in front of you. So while we are ensuring that certain individuals are not held because of their inability to pay, we have now made cash bail an impossibility in many cases where it would have a function.
So that's really interesting. I know there's been a debate about whether maybe judges should have more discretion to be able to look at a person's history or look at a person's reoffending and maybe say that that person should be kept because of their history or maybe their ties to a community. What do you think about that? Do you think that would help or hurt? Some people seem to think that that might be negative because of some biases of judges.
Sure. My thought is that you start with presumptive release. Someone is innocent until proven guilty. They have a right to be free pretrial. And then if a judge can articulate particular concern about a threat to a certain place or a person, an actual articulable concern based upon the person's criminal history or the actions in front of them, that they would have the discretion at that point to set some bail in the interest of public safety. And then maybe we have an intermediary review. I mean, there's certainly an opportunity to have a lower court bail review by a higher court now, but maybe we do something that's even quicker, something that's more automatic, just to put a second set of eyes on what occurred. I mean, one of the problems that is not addressed in any of the legislation is that we have town and village judges, some of whom are not attorneys. While they receive a certain amount of training, they haven't received the training to make the assessment to do these things. So perhaps some funding to make sure that what's being done in the middle of the night in some of the smaller towns is quickly reviewed by someone else.
So you're representing Rensselaer County, which if some of our viewers downstate or in Western New York don't know, it's a county that's right outside of Albany, but it has a lot of rural areas. It does represent the city of Troy, which is one of the larger cities in our region here, but you have a lot of town and village justices there. Is that what you've been seeing, that some of them maybe don't know everything about the law, or maybe it's confusing to go through it? There were a lot of changes as part of it.
Sure. Since I've been district attorney over the last year, and I sat as a judge in one of our larger towns prior to that, I do think that we have done a good job in Rensselaer County of keeping track of our incarcerated individuals because we are small enough that can be done. But again, this town and village system is pervasive throughout upstate New York. And the fact that we have sometimes non-attorney judges setting bail, I think that is something that should be addressed in this situation. in Rensselaer County, we're fortunate to have a program where we typically have a defense attorney at arraignment. That doesn't happen all over the state.
Right.
So these are the things that I'm surprised were left out of the equation, things that could have helped protect the rights of the accused while balancing the public safety aspect, because, you know, there are situations where someone has committed an offense that is not a qualifying offense, but there's a good reason to be fearful of that person being at liberty immediately after arraignment.
I know it's only been about 3 weeks into the law, so this may be a little premature, but you know, in your county, have you seen anybody be released because of this bail law and maybe reoffend doing a similar crime or, you know, something else that may be charged?
Yeah, in our county, we haven't had a specific instance of that. I mean, I've been following around the state. I know there was just one in Nassau County where an individual had been charged with a violation of their interlock and then went out and killed someone in a drunk driving accident. So I'm thankful that it has not happened in Rensselaer County yet, but obviously the potential is there. What we have seen is the release of individuals who were incarcerated over the prior months and an influx of victims calling our office. I can't believe he's out. Obviously, we did our best to advise them that it was going to happen, but right. I think a lot of people didn't fully comprehend that, yes, on January 1, they're going to be released from custody. So we had an individual out in Hoosick Falls where there was a situation, an axe through a window at a domestic partner. There was a history of domestic abuse there, and that person was not held on bail.
Well, there's certainly more to come, definitely more to watch in the coming weeks. Mary Pat Donnelly, Rensselaer County DA, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
Hi, I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union, and now we're at the Reporters Roundtable, where I am happy to be joined by Keisha Klukey from Bloomberg Law and John Campbell from the USA Today Network. All right, we are now more than a week past State of the State, and I think probably the biggest issue that is still weighing on people, especially policymakers around the state, is how New York is going to address the looming $6 billion Medicaid deficit. Specifically in response to a line the governor used in his speech where he said maybe it's time for localities to pick up more of the cost of increase in the program that for the last couple of years has been borne by the state. And now apparently the governor said, oh, no, don't worry about it. Localities aren't going to have to cover that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, New York has a setup for their Medicaid system where the state covers a piece of it and the locality covers a piece of it, which, you know, doesn't happen in a lot of states, most states. But in New York, that is a big cost for the state, a huge cost for the state, and it's a big cost for local governments. And the governor made a point of saying, you know, well, you know, under his administration, they picked up the growth in Medicaid costs for localities. And he's talked about how that's contributed to some budget woes for the state. And that really sent shockwaves across local governments who are putting together their own budgets, who rely on the state for aid and to avoid mandates, although there are many for local governments. And in particularly in New York City, that would be a particularly big cost if they had to shoulder some more of that burden. But you saw the governor kind of walk back from that. I mean, maybe it was a trial balloon to see how it would have gone, although I could have told you how that would have gone.
More like a terrifying trial zeppelin,
yes,
perhaps.
Yes, something like that. So, you know, you've seen that come back, but, you know, we won't know for sure until Tuesday when the governor lays out his budget. It'll be $160-something, $170 billion budget, and that's when we're going to get our answers.
And I thought it was interesting, too. I was speaking with the Association of Counties this week, and they weren't afraid at all. They were pretty assured that it wasn't going to happen. He just means we have to start tightening our belts, maybe finding efficiencies in the program. They didn't seem fazed. And I can't help but wonder if it was another way to dig at New York City, and maybe there will be finding savings there. It's the state picking up the growth in Medicaid spending. So it's about $4 billion statewide. But then it's $2 billion just New York City.
Right.
And that's if you're trying to fill a budget hole of 6.1, $4 billion is a heck of a way to get most of the way there.
So what are the proposals then? If it's not localities picking up that more of that share, the governor has already floated the idea of kind of reviving or amping up the power of the Medicaid redesign team, which is a project that went into place not long after the governor took office. I can remember covering those meetings, dealing with the very small minutiae of the program. Is that going to be enough to get you to $6 billion?
It's certainly a possibility that they will use that mechanism to try to get at least part of the way there. And it's also a clever way of pushing off responsibility in a certain sense. You know, you say, well, you know, it wasn't me that came up with these cuts. It was this panel of experts. But, you know, it actually did work pretty well when he first came into office facing a $10 billion deficit, which is 10 is larger than 6, it wouldn't surprise me in the least to see him go back to that mechanism and lean on it again.
And speaking of shifting, we're also doing this new, we did it last year, and then it looks like the governor's looking to do it again in perpetuity, which is shifting Medicaid spending to the next budget year,
right.
And which I wish I could do with my rent. Oh yeah, it's coming next year, I promise, and then next year it goes to the next year. And so we actually are also in this budget discussion on Tuesday, we're guessing, discussing the budget for this current fiscal year, which is $4 billion. He's found some savings through a 1% across-the-board cut in most Medicaid reimbursements. So services that have already been rendered, and they're now saying it's 1% less, which is about $124 million. And next year, we're going to have that 1%, which is about $500 million. So chipping away at little things and then shifting costs to future years are also in play.
With about 9 weeks to go in the current financial year.
Yeah, and listen, the two biggest pieces of the state budget are Medicaid spending and education spending. And you're going to see enormous pressure from education advocates to increase the amount of education spending in the budget. That is just going to be a clash with this $6 billion deficit and how that gets resolved, particularly with Democrats in control of the Senate and the legislature. Who have long pledged to increase education funding and have long spoken to the importance of that, you know, how those two competing principles come together is going to be a major piece of how this budget comes together.
All right, moving from the accounting prose to allegorical poetry, one thing that we weren't able to discuss last week on the show was the poster that the governor put out after the State of the State, which is a kind of amazing, complex, nautical allegory for what the state is going through. The state is depicted as a ship, you know, leadership, being buffeted by the winds of intolerance. And the governor was deeply involved in designing this poster, which got a ton of attention.
Yeah, absolutely. At the same time, he was crafting his State of the State address, which had a nautical theme, which was based largely on a Leonard Cohen song, Democracy, and which references ships of squall and the tides of hate and things like that. He was also working with a Brooklyn artist, Rusty Zimmerman, on a poster that is supposed to harken back to turn-of-the-century campaign posters. William Jennings Bryan, who was a Democratic presidential candidate, has a very famous campaign poster that is supposed to tell the story of his campaign and what he was pushing. The governor has done it twice before. This one captured quite a bit of attention because it's quite an image. There's a rainbow on the top that is the arc of moral justice, which is a reference to Martin Luther King. There's sea monsters. There's just a lot going on in this poster. And yeah, so you had a certain amount of the internet that was you know, mocking him for this. And then you had another part that was, I think, kind of understood what he was going for, which was an homage to, these historical posters of the past that he thinks very fondly of.
Speaking as a diehard Leonard Cohen fan, I dug it. But we should move on and talk about a change in personnel at the top of the State Committee on Open Government. Shoshana Buley, who came from the Office of Information Technology Services, where she served as counsel, has taken over the role of executive director, replacing Bob Freeman, who left in great shame under due to a sexual harassment scandal that apparently went on for years quietly. Buley has taken some heat as well as the process that brought her into office. From my paper, The Times Union, Chris Bragg reported on how the process was very, very secretive. Why is this position so important?
Well, and I mean, I think John can speak to it a little bit more, but I think that it's not a good start to have the office that's supposed to shine a light on state documents, as I think a lot of reporters go there. Bob Freeman, despite all of the scandal, was someone that reporters could go to and say, hey, this request didn't get through. How can I word it properly? And getting that information that people of the state are entitled to. And so having in secret someone coming in does not bode well for the position, and it makes you question how much does the governor's office have in control of it.
Done very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the committee is very, very important because it is supposed to be an advocate for the public to use transparency laws, the Freedom of Information Law and the Open Meetings Law, to their advantage. I mean, that for us as reporters, we use that office very, very frequently. I can only say that we hope that it remains independent and an advocate for the public and not for secrecy.
All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks very much to Keisha Kluke of Bloomberg Law and John Campbell of the USA Today Network.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org. And join us Tuesday, January 21st at 1 p.m. for live coverage of Governor Andrew Cuomo's 2020 budget address in Albany. The Capitol Press Room's David Lombardo will be with me at the desk for this special edition of New York Now. Until then, I'm Dan Clark. Thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.